Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, with COVID vaccinations beginning across the USA and the world, inequality and human rights are once again at the forefront. What are the human rights of health protection? And first, the U.S. is rejoining the Paris Climate Accords. What next steps need to be taken to mitigate the damage from the climate crisis?
Doug Becker explores.
Welcome to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. One of the first actions President Joe Biden took on the first day of his presidency was to return the United States to the Paris Climate Accords. On today's show, we explore what the U.S. return to the agreement means for the agreement itself, and we discuss what actions the U.S. should take to have the greatest immediate impact to address the climate crisis. And we examine what the next steps nations should take following these accords to strengthen global action to address global warming. Our guests today are Pamela Chasen, professor of political science at Manhattan College. She's the author of several books, including Global Environmental Politics, whose 8th edition came out last month. Larry Schweiger, who's the former president of the National Wildlife Federation. And Sharon Gibson, associate professor of international relations and environmental studies at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Environmental Praxis, Climate Activism, and the UNF-FCCC, a participatory action research approach. So first, I'd like to ask Pam Chasen, what exactly happened on Wednesday? What exactly does it mean to say the U.S. has returned to the Paris Climate Accords?
Well, as people may remember, that when the Paris Climate Accords were adopted in December 2015, it was adopted in such a way that it would not have to require the Senate to ratify the agreement. They did a little legal twister to ensure that this was just considered to be part and parcel of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, to which the United States was already a party. So in this regard, the Obama administration was able to immediately join it. However, because the fact that it didn't have to be ratified by the Senate, it also gave Donald Trump the ability to leave it without anything else, just to say, announce, we're leaving this. Now, mind you, countries can leave, come and go from treaties at any time. The Paris Climate Accords, however, were written in such a way that you could announce that you're going to leave it, but you could not take leave of it for 4 years. The original idea was to make this, in a sense, Trump-proof, that if Hillary Clinton was not, or a Democrat was not elected as the next president of the United States, that it would have to wait till 4 years after it entered into force. Nobody could have guessed that it entered into force right before the US presidential election in 2016, which negated that 4 year period because it left it within Donald Trump's purview. So because Donald Trump was so easily able to leave it, all it took was an executive order from President Biden to be able to rejoin it. And all he had to do was submit his intention to the United Nations to be reinscribed. And that'll take place in a number of days as set in the language of the treaty.
And so my understanding of when a state has signed as a part of the Paris Climate Accords, they set their own national action plan in addressing the climate crisis. Larry Schweiger, what should be a part of President Biden's action plan as the U.S. returns?
Well, I'll start by saying that, you know, the current commitments that all the countries have made fall way short of what we need. You know, the scientists suggested 1.5 degrees Celsius. The official position was 2 degrees, when actually we're going to get to 3 degrees if everybody does what they promised that they would do, which is doubtful. But so we all have to step it up. And the good news is that since I started and Pam started on this work many years ago, the price of clean energy has fallen very dramatically. So we're now in a situation where we can move to a clean energy future without having incurred the large cost that we would have had we done this 10 or 15 years ago. And for that reason, I think President Biden and the Congress ought to be looking at a straightforward mandate that reduces carbon emissions on a schedule that meets the goals of the science. And I think it's possible to actually accomplish that today. I don't think it's possible to do a Green New Deal or any of these other strategies that basically create revenue shifting to basically level the playing field among the American public. I don't think that would pass the Senate. We have a very split situation in the Senate, but I do think we can gather enough Republicans now who are being pressured by industry to move on a climate bill. It's really interesting. The industry itself is now aware of the urgency and they're moving faster than policy. And a number of them are clamoring for a climate policy. And I think the Republicans will have to step up and do the right thing. So I'm optimistic right now that we may be able to move a bill in Congress this session, and that we, by doing that, can remind the rest of the nations that we all need to step up, and that America's in for real this time.
And Shannon Gibson, there's been quite a bit of conversation concerning the climate crisis and the need for climate action, that not all communities are affected equally, and there are particularly vulnerable communities that may be even more at risk. This environmental justice movement. First, could you describe for us exactly sort of what are some of the main principles of environmental justice and how the environmental justice movement views the need for climate action?
Yes, so it's been well documented that the countries that have done the least to cause the climate crisis are those that are the first and worst affected, right? And so that's looking at the countries of the global south, our developing countries, our low-lying island states, least developed countries. But even within developed countries, we see that those that bear the burden are typically those that live in ecologically vulnerable spots in the United States, because that's generally where land may be cheaper in some cases. Communities of color, indigenous peoples, women, those on the lower socioeconomic sort of ladder are the ones, you know, that when we have heat waves that are walking to work, that don't have the ability to turn on air conditioning, that are more like with indigenous peoples that are more ecologically dependent because they live a subsistence life. So when you take some of those considerations within the environmental justice movement, while the rest of the world is rejoicing that President Biden has signed to rejoin the Paris Agreement, this group is a little bit more hesitant. In a sense, they say, you know, this is a first step, but that was easy. As Pam was talking about, you know, he signed a piece of paper. It's what comes next that is the hard part. And even looking at yesterday, which was the 21st, John Kerry, who is now our lead of the climate envoy, gave an address to the G20 business leaders. And he kept saying over and over, you know, we need to ramp up our ambition that this, we're all in this together. This is a global initiative, no country left behind. And he acknowledged the last 4 years of US inaction, but what he didn't acknowledge was the last 150 years of historical responsibility that the United States bears. And so environmental justice and climate justice groups will be going to COP26 to tell the US that they need to ramp up their ambition beyond the Obama administration, to take on their fair share, right? To acknowledge their historical responsibility and really, you know, lead the way, and to not keep pointing at, you know, China and India and other emerging economies, but really to kind of shoulder their burden in this.
Shannon referenced the COP26 meetings, the upcoming meetings to address these questions of, you know, the need for climate action. Pam Chasek, I guess one of my first reactions to this, you said because Barack Obama was able to join the climate accords via executive action and Donald Trump was able to withdraw it, that it creates this perception that when the US signs agreements, it really depends on which party is in power. And so it definitely undermines the sense of US commitment to those agreements. What should the US do to demonstrate a greater commitment, you know, to these agreements? Is there any way the U.S. can sort of make up for this loss of reputation that the withdrawal from Paris caused?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is take care of it at home. If we're to if we pass legislation that'll reduce our greenhouse gas emissions through moving to more renewable sources of energy is a really good first step, and to find other ways that we can reduce our emissions, because one of the best ways to show our leadership is to do it, is, you know, not just to talk about it, but to show action. And if we get it through Congress, which is a big challenge, it's a very, you know, divided Congress, but I think, as Larry mentioned, we can find a win-win situation here, and to be able to demonstrate what we are able to do legislatively will put us back in a position of leadership internationally. If we can't do anything at home, and if it's just executive orders, then we're not a leader. It's helpful that we've got, that the Biden administration has put together a really top-notch team to deal with climate change, and have recognized that it's not just for a single office of a climate envoy like John Kerry to do, but it has to be throughout the administration. And so Janet Yellen at Treasury, knowing her, that she is also good on this issue, people, you know, EPA, Interior, all of the different offices are going to have to be part of this. And some of the things that can be done without legislation can be done at the federal level, in terms of, which had been done before, but in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in federal buildings, in the federal auto fleet, how travel is done, et cetera. But to be able to get it across the country, we really need domestic legislation. And that will then, I think, demonstrate leadership much more than just showing up in meetings. We've always been at the meetings. You know, it's not to say we haven't been there, and we have sat in as observers in all the Paris Agreement discussions. Actually, we didn't withdraw from Paris until quite recently. So we were there. We've been part of the table, but everyone knows in the United Nations and in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change that the United States has trouble getting things through Congress because of climate denialism among, you know, I'm going to point out, particularly among the Republican Party. And so for us to regain any hope of leadership, we've got to act first at home.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the implications of the U.S. return to the Paris Climate Accords and the need for greater climate action with Pamela Chasick of Manhattan College, Larry Schweiger of the National Wildlife Federation, and Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California. Now, Larry Schweiger, you were describing the need for action. If I, you know, hear this correctly, in the past, there's been this tendency to offer financial incentives or means by which, you know, economic incentives for American business to be able, you know, to take steps to try to address the climate crisis. And, but you were saying that perhaps the days of that might be too soft of a position, that the United States really needs to mandate rather than just, you know, create financial incentives. First of all, am I hearing your comments correctly? And do you see a real opposition to that if the targets become much harder as opposed to being, you know, financial incentives?
Well, one of the challenges we've faced in the past is that the cap and trade and cap and tax, all these different strategies have been attacked, in some cases calling them socialism, and that seems to be a common theme lately. The interesting thing is, because the cost of energy has changed so dramatically, coal has gone up in cost, natural gas with fracking has flattened out, but is nowhere able to be competitive with wind and solar with batteries now are falling below the cost of these other sources. So it makes sense to start a mandated program to ratchet down the carbon-based energy sources and allow the clean energy to grow. Now, I believe strongly that we ought to be offering money through loans to small businesses, to churches, to synagogues, to schools, and to private homeowners to accelerate their investment in clean energy. But clearly, we can do this And we should also find ways to offset those who are in an economic situation that they need some help otherwise. So I think the less complicated we make a law, the more direct we make it, the simpler it is. I was involved in the Clean Air Act in 1970 and the Clean Water Act in 72. And we did not throw a bunch of federal money at those, although we did on clean water with sewage treatment. But on the other discharges, we did not put up a bunch of money. We simply said, this is pollution. You need to stop it. Get your act together and pay for it. And companies, by and large, did that. And I think that's the pattern that we should be thinking about now, because the costs have gone down so dramatically. I wouldn't have said that a year ago. I wouldn't have said it 2 years ago. But now with the declining cost of energy, clean energy, this is an option and one that avoids some of the rancor that we've seen in the past.
So one of the themes here is the U.S. needing to take action itself in order to demonstrate a commitment, but also one of the real key themes is going to be funding, is going to be financing, for this. So Shannon Gibson, particularly from this environmental justice perspective, I know there's this component of the Paris Climate Accords, this Green Climate Fund, that's meant to try to make steps towards mitigation and adaptation and dealing with climate change, trying to ease some of the financial cost on for poorer countries. Should that be the focus in trying to address some of these justice concerns, and therefore helping poorer countries around the world be able to implement this? Or should the emphasis really be on taking action here in the United States, because the U.S., as we know, is one of the most significant carbon emitters?
Well, I would say I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, but that finance is for sure one of the package of issues that the climate justice movement is really going to be honing in on at the COP26 talks in Glasgow. First, we need to recognize that as a result of COVID-19, well, it's before COVID-19, developing countries already had diminished administrative and scientific capacity to deal a lot with climate mitigation and adaptation. So this idea of capacity building, technology transfer, funding was already on the table. But COVID-19 has now squeezed those developing economies so much more. So funding from developed countries will certainly be crucial. But it's not just the amount of funding, it's also the type of funding. What we have seen in the past with, say, funding promises that were made back at COP15 in Copenhagen, when we go back and look back at the funding that came, a lot of times that funding wasn't new. What a country would do would say, take funding for female literacy programs and then shift it to climate mitigation, or funding for HIV and AIDS medication programs and then shift it to climate change. So first, that money needs to be new and additional. Second, that money should be coming as bilateral. It should be investment. It shouldn't be interest-based loans. That's another huge concern of developing countries. So it's not just that we need to seriously ramp up the amount of money in the Green Climate Fund, which is very much lacking, but that the structure of that funding also needs to be equitable.
And Pam Chasick, on the future of climate action, the COP26 meetings are going to be held in Glasgow later this year. Are there new issues that are being proposed to be put on this, put on the agenda to try to strengthen climate action? Or is the emphasis going to be on trying to achieve already agreed upon campaigns?
Well, one of the things, by the end of 2020, all parties to the Paris Accord were supposed to submit what are called their nationally determined contributions, which means under the Paris Climate Agreement, it is a bottom-up agreement. Countries can determine themselves how much they're going to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and how they're going to do it. So they set their own targets. What's legally binding there is that they have to report on it. And there has to be transparency in reporting and how this is done. So according to the agreement, by the end of 2020, everyone was supposed to submit updated and enhanced NDCs, as they're called. And recognizing, as Larry had said earlier, that the existing NDCs are not nearly enough to keep temperature increase to below 1.5 degrees Celsius or even the higher target of 2.0. So the first, the idea originally, the COP in Glasgow was supposed to be in 2020. Needless to say, everything in 2020 was postponed. And so hopefully, if it can take place at the end of 2021, which is still in question, they need to review all of, you know, the updated NDCs. They need to call for them to be strengthened because they're not going to be enough, and figure, you know, there's going to be continued calls for climate finance, as Shannon just pointed out, particularly because the pledges to the Green Climate Fund did not reach the targets, to be able to help developing countries, both with adaptation and mitigation. And then finally, one of the issues in what's called the Paris Rulebook that still hasn't been agreed to is how to deal with market mechanisms. And they were supposed to reach agreement on that in 2019, and they couldn't. They had hoped to in 2020. We didn't meet. So that's still on the table for 2021, of how countries can use, you know, different forms of mechanisms, to market mechanisms to meet their NDCs. So as of right now, now this all could change. And one of the other things that, you know, I've been hearing people talking about is we have seen reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in 2020 because of COVID. However, as soon as travel resumes, we're going to see those emission reductions disappear. So how can we maintain our emissions reductions, and how can we change what business as usual was pre-COVID? So we keep talking about going back to normal, but we need to define what that new normal is in a more environmentally friendly way.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the implications of the U.S. return to the Paris Climate Accords and the need for greater climate action with Pamela Chasick of Manhattan College, Larry Schweiger of the National Wildlife Federation, and Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California. Kind of an important point for me is that since 2020 and the COVID pandemic, we've seen some real reductions in some areas for carbon emissions. So this argument that whatever action we're going to take isn't going to have any sort of an impact has been disproven kind of involuntarily because we're not able to travel, but they've demonstrated some of that. But this call to return to some degree of normalcy, Larry Schweiger, certainly, I know you're optimistic about congressional action. I can't help but think the Democrats currently have a 50-50 majority, and one of those is Joe Manchin, who is pretty closely tied to the coal industry in West Virginia. What kind of legislation do you expect with the current Congress? If you were advising President Biden, perhaps, you know, you have been, what would you recommend be at the top of the list, something that you think we could get in the next, say, 3 months or so, the first 100 days?
That's a great point. One of the things that we haven't talked about is that transportation is our number one source of carbon pollution now. And of all people on this planet, Joe Biden understands the need to rebuild and to take our rail infrastructure to a very new place. And, you know, Pete Buttigieg has been moving through the confirmation process with incredible speed, because he's the person that's going to have the money bags. And he also did a great job on his interview. But it's really important that we change our method of transportation. And the good news in that area is that clean energy cars, electric cars, are just kicking butt, so to speak, on transportation. And I think you're going to see a dramatic shift. All the auto manufacturers are moving as fast as they can now to try to catch up with Tesla. I've been driving a Tesla for several years now and love it. It's a no maintenance car. Basically, you got electric motors and electric battery system and a computer, and that's about it. So, you know, we're seeing a tremendous change in the auto industry itself. But I also think we need to build a high-speed rail system, and I think we need to modernize our entire transportation system, and that will be a very positive thing for everybody involved. Even the Republicans yesterday were sending signals that they wanted Pete to come visit them, because they know that there's going to be a lot of effort put into finally into an infrastructure bill that will focus largely on transportation. So I'm optimistic about that side of the equation as well as the stationary sources.
Now, Shannon Gibson, I know during the campaign, there was this perception that Joe Biden, you know, his history has been as a pretty moderate Democrat, certainly was not the choice of progressives within the party, but he seems to be signaling that climate action is an issue that he's willing to reach out quite a bit to progressives. As somebody who I feel comfortable saying identifies with the progressive wing at this point, what would you like to see him commit to in these first 100 days that really demonstrate that this is not just, you know, promises and rhetoric, but there's actually some real action?
Well, yeah, I think we've seen an interesting sort of evolution of environmental policy asks from the progressive side, from the Green New Deal now to the Thrive agenda. And it is true, as both of my colleagues have mentioned here, that it's going to be tough because we don't have an overwhelming congressional majority to pass some of these very progressive stances. I think that what could be useful, though, for President Biden in the first 100 days would be to couple some of these climate action aims with COVID recovery. So that if we make just transition, building back the economy, but we do so in a green manner, so not just bringing back oil and coal jobs, but bringing back green technology jobs, right? That serves both those who are concerned about the economy and these climate justice concerns as well. And then obviously there will need to be some targeting of those communities who've been the hardest hit by COVID. And so to look at these crises, you know, the climate crisis is not just carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, right? The climate crisis is a jobs crisis. It's a political crisis. It is an energy crisis. You know, all these things build upon and layer upon one another. And so I think that maybe if he can bundle them together to say, like, as a part of pulling ourselves out of the COVID economic crisis in a green manner, that that could help maybe bridge the aisle a little bit.
Yes, Pam Chasick, you want to respond as well?
Yeah, I just wanted to add something. A lot of this comes in terms of how this is framed. And by framing for the American public, framing for Congress, you know, and what Shannon said makes really good sense is that if you were to put in as part of COVID recovery in terms of jobs, you know, helping people survive economically, includes job training for green energy jobs, includes jobs that come through infrastructure development, looking at all of that. And if you frame it that way, because in some circles, climate change is still essential, you know, is a bad word. And as soon as you use climate change or global warming, you're going to see all of this negativity. I mean, Ted Cruz tweeted immediately after Joe Biden signed that we are going back into the Paris Agreement saying, well, why do we need to listen to what people in Paris are saying? We need to listen to what people in Pittsburgh are saying. And I saw another retweet, someone tweeted it saying, well, I guess the Geneva Accords mean we're only listening to what people in Geneva had to say. And so, you know, but as soon as you say climate change, you're going to start getting this, you know, anti-climate, not just in Twitter, but also on the floor in Capitol Hill. So by pairing it with COVID, by pairing it with infrastructure, by pairing it with all of these other issues and getting it through that way will have the same effect and possibly avoid some of the political rancor.
And Larry Schwager, I'll give you the last word on this. I know you've got a lot of experience at framing these issues. Do you have anything additionally that you'd like to add about how we might be able to frame this issue to have a bit more legislative success?
That's a really good point. You know, I was in a conversation with Biden back several years ago, and he was reflecting on his own state of Delaware. We saw the other day how much he loves his home state. 40% of the state of Delaware is going to be underwater if we fail to act. And, you know, we have so much at stake. The cost of inaction is so much greater than the cost of action today, particularly with the drop in energy costs for clean energy. So I really think we need to be framing this in an economic frame and talking about it as a least cost approach to our future. And the countries that lead the way are going to do the best. The Europeans are massively moving in the direction of clean energy cars, over 200,000 cars sold in a single month in Europe. We need to stay with them and catch up and move in the right direction. So I think Biden gets this. I know he does. And he's going to push in every way he can. He's got an excellent team, an outstanding team, and a team that really knows how to get things done. So I'm optimistic. I don't know exactly what they're going to frame up for climate legislation, but I know, having the years of experience that Biden has in the Senate, he knows what he can get done and what he can't get done. So I think he'll do the very best he can, and we'll see some good change, I believe, in the next 4 years.
Well, thank you very much. We've been discussing the U.S. decision to return to the Paris Climate Accords, what the needs for future action on future climate action, and what some of the demands of the environmental justice movement to try to address the issues of communities that are more marginalized and more at risk than climate change as a way to move forward in dealing with the climate crisis. Our guests have been Pamela Chasick, professor of political science at Manhattan College and the author of the newest 8th edition of Global Environmental Politics, which came out last month. Larry Schweiger, the former president of the National Wildlife Federation, and Shannon Gibson, associate professor of international relations and environmental studies at the University of Southern California. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, how is inequality affecting COVID vaccinations? Who is getting vaccinated? What might be a global approach to vaccine nationalism and equitable access to health protection? Sohak toh pardes merin tagerov kumber tagisachirin bayt nalali se du sohak miga. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The vaccinations of COVID-19 have once again raised the issue of human rights. What is the relationship between human rights and global health in the distribution of COVID vaccines? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In the midst of the global pandemic, the development of vaccines offer hope for global health action. But the task of distributing the vaccine has multiple human rights concerns, including issues of vaccine nationalism and equitable distribution to marginalized communities. We examine the human rights considerations of vaccine distribution and communities with vulnerabilities with Joanne Lin, who is the National Director of Amnesty International USA's Advocacy and Government Affairs Departments, and Heather Whipfley, Associate Professor of Clinical Preventative Medicine and International Relations at the University of Southern California. Joanne Lin, let's start with you. What are some of the human rights concerns that we should be considering as vaccines get distributed to try to address the COVID crisis?
Well, good afternoon, Doug. It's lovely to be with you, and thank you for inviting me today. The COVID-19 scourge has claimed more than 2 million lives and has triggered a global economic calamity. And desperate for relief from the worst pandemic in a century, countries have struck deals to secure vaccine access. For Amnesty International, we are urging the Biden administration to apply an international human rights framework to vaccine distribution, one that prioritizes vaccines for those highest at risk, regardless of what country they live in and how much money they have. If the pandemic has taught us anything, it's that we are only as safe as those most at risk, and we won't be completely safe until those individuals at highest risk are vaccinated. And those include health workers, essential workers, older adults, those with underlying health conditions, those unable to physically distance, including people in nursing homes, prisons, and detention facilities. Amnesty International is particularly concerned about the situation facing refugees, migrants, displaced peoples, as well as people in prisons and immigration detention facilities. By definition, these people live in overcrowded conditions, and they do not have control over their living situation. In many circumstances, they do not have access to basic water, clean hygiene, and are not able to socially distance according to public health protocols. Moreover, they live at the fringes of society, in some cases not even recognized by the governments or the countries where they happen to live. And so Amnesty International is closely watching national vaccination programs and urging governments around the world to ensure that refugees, displaced people, migrants, as well as prisoners and detainees are included, and not only included, but prioritized in vaccine distribution.
And Heather Whiffley, what do you see as some of the real human rights concerns that we face in vaccine distribution?
Well, according to international human rights laws and norms, governments have the responsibility to provide all individuals safe, available, accessible, and affordable access to healthcare that's required for them to live full, healthy lives. And this includes concepts of non-discrimination. So regardless of whether or not an individual can pay, they should have access to those essential services that are required for their health. And certainly in the context of our COVID pandemic, access to safe, available, and accessible vaccines is an essential right that all individuals have. And in the context of our current pandemic, the real challenge here lies in ensuring, as Joanne mentioned, those of our most vulnerable communities have access. And so in addition to these migrant and refugee communities, making sure that those lowest income communities on our planet, including those in the least income countries around the world, have access to the vaccine in a timely fashion. And this is not only essential for their own health, but for all of our healths, as we're also interconnected. Just in the last 24 hours, we've been receiving news of a new strain of the virus coming out of South Africa that appears to be more lethal. And it is in that context that we understand that all of, that we need to get control over the virus in all areas of the planet in order to prevent the further mutation and spread of an even more deadly virus.
So Joanne Lynn, you'd stated a set of principles, very powerful set of principles. Are there specific areas that are of a particular concern, at this point, areas that you think, I know vaccine distribution has just begun relatively recently, but areas, Heather Whiffley had mentioned South Africa as this new strain. I don't know if that's one of those. Are there some areas that we should particularly pay close attention to that seem to be problematic?
Yes. So, the start of the global vaccination campaign we're only a month into it in the United States and 48 higher income countries. And what we've seen over the past month is very unequal access to vaccines and varying degrees of efficiency in getting the shots into people's arms. While the U.S. is nearing 1 million shots weekly, most countries have yet to give their first shots. And what has unfolded is this mad scrum for vaccines, where not surprisingly, the richest countries in the world are doing fairly well. They've accumulated extensive supply deals. And in some cases, some countries are hoarding vaccines, buying enough immunizations to immunize their population several times over. Canada and the United States notably are in that category. But not surprisingly, lower income countries with weaker healthcare systems are left in the dust. If the present course continues, some of these countries may have to wait until 2022 or later before supplies are widely available. Duke University's Global Health Innovation Center estimates that there will not be enough vaccines to cover the world's population until at least 2023. According to Bloomberg, Guinea is the only low-income country to date to have delivered any shots so far. And that was last week when Guinea provided doses of the vaccine to 25 people.
Now, Heather Whiffley, I know there are international provisions to try to ensure a relatively, at least equitable, distribution of vaccines in cases of global pandemics through the World Health Organization. What exactly governs those provisions and I'll ask you the follow-up. The U.S. has rejoined or announced rejoining the World Health Organization. What impact is that going to have on the effectiveness of the WHO?
Yeah, well, in fact, there really aren't really strong international governance mechanisms to ensure that there is sufficient vaccine manufacturing and provision in the case of a pandemic. And so with the advent of the COVID pandemic, the World Health Organization has launched a number of initiatives to try to generate both funding and manufacturing and delivery of these essential vaccines and therapeutics to treat COVID. One of those initiatives is called COVAX. It's an initiative largely run through the Gavi Alliance, which is this global alliance for vaccines that provides kind of the essential vaccines to the least developed countries, the lowest income countries around the world. And so excitingly, in the last 24 hours, not only did the United States rejoin the WHO, but it also joined the COVAX initiative, which has been really struggling to generate the type of investment that it really needs in order to ensure that it can deliver the numbers of vaccinations that are required. I mean, the numbers here are just mind-boggling, right? We have to vaccinate practically every individual on the planet. So we're talking upwards of 8 billion vaccines that need to be administered in a relatively quick period of time. So obviously there are bottlenecks, but we have to ensure, it's a moral imperative and a human rights imperative, that we don't just go with the richest first, and that we have access to those vulnerable populations that are most at risk once they get the virus and have the least resources to be able to treat it. And so that's kind of the goal of COVAX. And they've made a number of initiatives, a number of agreements so far to try to secure those vaccines that they're going to, they say, start delivering within the next month. But the rubber hasn't hit the road yet, right? There's so much secrecy right now around these various agreements that have been made between countries and manufacturers. So, and the funds haven't actually been delivered yet. So it's not entirely clear at this point what the timeline and what the numbers are for that initiative in particular to try to get vaccines into those least developed countries.
Now, thus far, we've been talking mostly about what nations might have access to vaccines, the concern with vaccine nationalism, countries developing the vaccines, wanting to make sure that that their populations are vaccinated first before the vaccines go elsewhere. Joanne Lynn, is that the primary concern at this point, kind of a vaccine nationalism, or how much should we be concerned about marginalized populations, even within the countries that do have access to the vaccine, and also the possibility of it being a question of cost, that populations that can afford to pay for the vaccine can get the vaccine, or is the expectation the vaccine is going to be distributed free of charge?
There are a lot of great questions in there, so I will try to unpack them as best I can, Doug. You know, as Heather mentioned, there are some 8.49 billion doses that have already been set aside. And that number would be sufficient to cover more than half the world's population if the shots were distributed evenly. But what we're seeing is anything but even an equitable distribution. So is it a question of vaccine nationalism? Certainly that was the case under our prior president, and he made that very clear. Former President Trump had issued an executive order on December 8th that was about America first and ultimately America only, to the extent of prioritizing vaccine distribution for all Americans before anyone else in the world. We know that that would not be effective in terms of protecting the health of even Americans, and it certainly is problematic from a human rights perspective. The head of the World Health Organization this past Monday delivered some very stern words for the entire international community and said that the world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure, and the price of this failure will be paid with lives and livelihoods in the world's poorest countries. He said it was wrong to see people at low risk in wealthy countries being vaccinated while most of the world still did not have access to vaccines. It is not right that younger, healthier adults in rich countries are vaccinated before health workers and older people in poorer countries. It's precisely at a moment like this, right now, when an international human rights framework can actually take life and be meaningful to ensure that we can meet this moment where the pandemic is hitting every corner of the world, knowing that ultimately the world, through respective governments and multiple pharmaceutical companies and many vaccines underway, can ultimately deliver a vaccine to all of those people, especially those at highest risk first. But if vaccine nationalism predominates, if wealth drives the course here, what we're going to see is basically what we've seen in 2020, which has been a mad scrum and trends that are all trending terribly, whether it's the rise in cases or the rise in deaths, and the world still not being able to get a tackle on this pandemic.
Yes, Heather Whiffley, I'd like to respond as well.
I just really want to emphasize what Joanne was saying, that it's not just about vaccine nationalism, but it's also about wealth. And I think we can't let the pharmaceutical industry off the hook in this case. And that is in the fact that they are still going for profits on these vaccines. Even under the COVAX negotiations, they're charging around $20 per person for vaccination, which is well above the price that's going to be affordable to get the world vaccinated. And so Moderna, and just in the past month, has decided to provide zero vaccine to South Africa. And the others are kind of joining on that you know, track as well. And so there's really an issue on the part of the vaccine manufacturing and provision, not just at the national level, but at a pharmaceutical level, whether they're either going to provide them at an affordable cost. And there really is a lack of transparency around what these manufacturing costs are and how much would be an ethical price at which we should be charged in order to get access to them. And, you know, another, speaking of human rights, you know, international human rights recognizes that intellectual property is a human construct that can and should be waived in the presence of a health emergency. And there have been requests to the World Trade Organization by low-income countries asking for a waiver for intellectual property regarding COVID vaccine technology and therapeutic technology. And so far, the United States, the EU, the UK, Japan, Australia, Switzerland, Norway, Canada, they're all opposing and blocking this waiver and protecting the intellectual property rights of these vaccine manufacturers, even when most of that research and most of that science was supported and provided through taxpayer money. So there's a number of moral failures there when it comes to this strive for wealth over the health and safety of the global population.
I'm really glad that Heather mentioned the intellectual property issue, because just earlier today, Amnesty International sent a letter to the National Security Council in the Biden White House raising this particular intellectual property issue. Because although yesterday the president announced that the U.S. will remain in the World Health Organization and will join and support COVAX, on the issue of these intellectual property rights, Heather's absolutely right that the U.S. is on the wrong side, along with Canada and the U.K., in opposing an intellectual property waiver. While at the same time, these are the same countries that are buying up and reserving enough vaccines to inoculate their populations at least four times over. So importantly, it's countries like India and South Africa that are leading the push at the WHO to waive these intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines and treatments. And the activists strongly believe that a waiver of these intellectual property rights would significantly increase supplies, both by allowing any qualified manufacturer to produce the supplies without fear of being sued or prosecuted.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker, and we're discussing the human rights concerns and considerations for vaccine distribution globally. So, Heather Whiffley, so far we've been talking mostly about the health provisions. Healthcare is an aspect of human rights, the individual's rights, to vaccinations, to healthcare treatment, et cetera. We've made these references to other human rights I'd really like to explore in greater detail. The first is the economic impact, in particular for populations that cross borders for business, you know, or cross borders for employment, and then also populations such as asylum seekers or refugee populations that certainly can be left out of a vaccine distribution, or at least at the sort of at the bottom of that list. How salient are those two areas of human rights when we think about what's the right way to distribute the vaccine?
Well, you're absolutely right in pointing out that the human rights implications of the COVID pandemic have reached far beyond health. They touch on all types of social and political rights as well. They've been hurt, and governments have also taken advantage of the crisis to further, constrain some rights related to socioeconomic rights and political rights. So we do have to, having that framework is important, looking at the broad spectrum of the negative impacts that COVID has had on individuals. And there's also a number of civil rights, which is a whole different issue, but getting at, who has the right to deny whether or not they want to take the vaccine, how much pressure are individuals under to adhere to the vaccine drive. So I think that, that's a huge issue. And certainly in this case, all of those rights are important, and it's why taking a human rights framework is so important when considering the overall implications of the pandemic.
Please go ahead.
I was just going to continue in terms of what Heather was talking about with respect to refugees and displaced peoples, because there's some immediate steps that the Biden administration can undertake to ensure that asylum seekers waiting in northern Mexico for humanitarian protection in the United States, there's some critical steps that the Biden administration can and must take. And so first, the Biden administration needs to rescind this baseless March 2020 CDC order. This was imposed at the onset of the pandemic, even though it was not supported by science. And the CDC's top scientists found that there was no scientific basis, but former Vice President Pence instructed then CDC Director Redfield to issue a directive which would basically invoke the CDC's emergency powers to seal the US borders, overruling the CDC scientists who found there was no evidence that that closing the borders would slow the spread of COVID-19. So even though the Biden administration has issued a panoply of most important and welcome immigration and asylum orders, this March 20 CDC order is still in place, and it's not supported by science, and it needs to be revoked immediately. In addition, the United States needs to ensure that in addition to the vaccine distribution, that governments are proactively including refugees, migrants, and displaced people in vaccination plans. And so the US should provide support to host countries that host millions of refugees. These are countries like Uganda, Bangladesh, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, that host millions of refugees. And the US should press those countries to enroll refugees in the national health insurance schemes. The US should work with the international community to ensure that all displaced people have timely and accurate information and healthcare. And they should also ensure that NGOs and support programs are able to address increased levels of gender-based violence, which have been documented to be on the rise across the world during this year of COVID lockdowns. So there are many different things that the United States can and should do in terms of leading the international community's response to COVID. It's not just limited to vaccine distribution.
I guess one of the lessons, Heather Whitfield, that we've taken from this is there's certainly been a history of the use of pandemics and other and health threats as a justification for other human rights implications. Lack of ability to travel, for example. I think of the way in which SARS was framed in a way to try to cut off travel, and certainly Ebola outbreaks recently as a way to try to regulate, if not completely limit, travel. And the suspicion that COVID was a wonderful excuse to, to close the border and start talking about, building more sections of the wall. Is that accurate? The use of pandemics as a justification for a lack of concern for a whole lot of other human rights?
Well, there's no question that over the past year, governments around the world have taken advantage of the pandemic to further marginalize vulnerable populations and to violate human rights amongst populations at risk. But that doesn't have to be the case. And just, you know, just to think about some of the frameworks around human rights that can be used to ensure that that's not the case. One is that, you know, we really want to have these decisions and these limitations that are put in place and be science-based. And that's one of the great, you know, things about the past 24 hours in the United States has been this return back to science and evidence as a platform for making these decisions and really, you know, having to have that scientific justification for the policies that are being undertaken. And also that they're time limited and they have a real specific horizon for their expiration. And so that we see that this is a crisis that has to be dealt based on the evidence and that we will then move beyond that. And so we have a clear idea for why these limitations are being placed either on our movement or on our behaviors. And those are critical both to not only to protect our human rights, but also from a public health perspective, because if populations begin to lose faith and lose trust in the public health decisions being made, and they start to see them more as human rights violations or mechanisms of control, then they start rebelling against them and they're no longer, you know, going to be following them. And we see their effectiveness start to erode. And so on both sides, either from the human rights perspective and the public health perspective, it's really important that all these political decisions, these policies decisions be time limited, evidence-based, and you know, in line with other human rights frameworks.
I think that's a wonderful place, a wonderful conclusion, you know, to end. And ultimately, the importance of thinking of vaccine distribution, both from the public health perspective, as well as from the human rights perspective, it's really not an either or, but it's very much a kind of hand in glove approach. These considerations need to be in connection with one another. We have been discussing the human rights and public health considerations on vaccine distribution with Joanne Lynn, who is the National Director of Amnesty International USA's Advocacy and Government Affairs Division, and Heather Whipfley, Associate Professor of Clinical Preventive Medicine and International Relations at the University of Southern California. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.